Welcome back. Today I am joined by Nicola Rehani. Nicola is a psychologist and professor of evolution and behaviour at UCL, and her book, The Social Instinct, explores how cooperation shaped the world. Nicola, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
I'm really looking forward to this one. I personally am someone who's, you know, I encourage myself and others to think and rethink, to challenge your own bias, and to just always be open to learning. So I'm often listening to lots of different books. I'll be listening to lots of different podcasts. And, you know, on this podcast, I speak to different people each week and different industries with varying expertise. And the key thing that I want my listeners to take away are, of course, some insights and some ideas that they can use themselves to impact their own lives and the lives of others around them. So that could be habit and behavior change. It could be listening to the show to get motivated or to increase discipline, or just an opportunity to listen and learn and get inspired. So many questions for you today, Nicola, and I know that the work that you do, the book, it's all fascinating to me. So I think a good place to start with you would be if you could tell us how and why you first started investigating social behaviour in humans and in other species.
Sure. So I've always been sort of fascinated by social behaviour, and I think partly that is because it's just so integral to what makes us human. So I don't think there are any aspects of our lives that aren't affected by social behaviour or by social interaction in some way. So, you know, even just considering something as simple as your morning commute, to some of our greatest achievements as a species. So things like sending rockets into space, or producing vaccines to a novel virus in under a year, or building the Sistine Chapel, all of these kinds of things, from the very, very mundane things that we take completely for granted, all the way through to our greatest achievements, hinge on our ability to interact productively with one another and to cooperate with one another. So I've always kind of found that very interesting, but funnily enough, I didn't actually start out by studying humans. My first foray into the study of social behaviour was a species that probably, well, I know not many people have heard of, and it's called the Pied Babbler. And that is a bird about the size of a blackbird, for people who are in the UK listening to this podcast, that lives in the Kalahari Desert. And they are interesting because they live in really tight-knit family groups where all the group works together to raise a single nest of chicks, a single clutch of offspring. And that was actually how I made my first foray into studying cooperation and social behavior, was on this sort of esoteric bird that I was chasing around the Kalahari Desert for the best part of 4 years.
Wow. Well, as you say, you know, it is really interesting to think about how behavior, everything from, you know, our day-to-day choices, I suppose, to the bigger things that we all share. And I think that's what I'm always interested in when I think about behavior, motivation, you know, what drives people essentially to do what they do. I think that's probably, you know, one of the reasons that I started the show, is I've always been interested in, yeah, what makes people tick, what makes them do what they do, and are there some common shared themes that we, you know, as you say, human nature, and what are the similarities and what are the differences? So I guess human nature, maybe that's also a good place to start. Like, I've heard you talk about how it's really important right now, especially the time that we're living in, for us to challenge the narrative that humans as a species are innately selfish, you know, individualistic, that we are competitive and destructive, and that this leads us to conflict. But actually, in fact, that we are very collaborative, and that cooperation has given us an advantage. So I guess, how do you define cooperation? And what is it about our ability to cooperate with one another that has given us an advantage evolutionary?
So for me, cooperation is basically working together to achieve mutual benefits. So we're cooperating when we get on a crowded train, for example, and we offer our seat to somebody who might need it. We're cooperating when we do things like wearing a face mask to protect people from airborne viruses. When we work together on team projects. So, you know, cooperation sort of infuses every aspect of our lives. And I think sometimes we can take it completely for granted. We actually don't see just how much cooperation is working behind the scenes in many of the things that we're doing. And I think another thing that we can also overlook, and particularly for people that live in modern industrialized societies, like I imagine many of the listeners to this podcast will, is that for the vast majority of our time on Earth, life for our species has been difficult. So we've spent the vast majority of our time on Earth as a species, we've spent in very difficult environments where we needed to work together to survive. So we know that humans evolved in sub-Saharan Africa in some of the most difficult and changeable regions on the planet, where food was difficult to come by. It had to be searched for or scavenged or killed. And at the same time, there were a bunch of things wandering around that would quite like to scavenge or kill us and maybe have us for lunch or something like that. So we really needed to work together to survive. And in some respects, I think this kind of evolutionary history, and this particularly the inhabiting these difficult regions, starts to sort of highlight some of the differences actually between humans and our closest living relatives on the planet, which are the other great apes, of course. And what we see in humans is that we are much, much more cooperative in many ways than any of the other great ape species. But in part, that's because we had to be. It's only us that lived in these difficult environments, or where we had this evolutionary history of adversity, if you like. And when we look at the kinds of environments that the contemporary great apes live in, so the chimpanzees, gorillas, bonobos, orangutans, they're really quite different to the kinds of environments that characterized the majority of human evolution. And, you know, I've said in the past, in some respects, you can think of the environments that the other great apes live in as being basically giant salad bowls, where it's pretty easy for individuals to find the food they need to support any dependent offspring they might have. And I think that these differences, this kind of evolutionary history of really being in difficult environments where we had to work together, is something which explains why we're so cooperative now still, and also highlights in many ways why our species has been so extraordinarily successful, and why we have managed to not only survive in those difficult environments, but to spread out from there and to thrive basically in almost every habitat on the planet.
Well, listening to that, I'm thinking, you know, it's important, isn't it, for us to look back and to look at the lessons of the past and to think how they might inform decisions that we would make in the future. Now, I'm someone who's always very future thinking. You know, I talk a lot about innovation and the future. And so I'm always looking ahead and thinking, OK, what could this look like? What could that scenario be? And so, of course, when you're describing, you know, difficult, environments in terms of survival as a human species, I suppose it does feel very, very different to the life. This is the world that we all live in now. And it feels like, okay, if we don't have this shared, I suppose, common goal or crisis or whatever that requires us to collaborate together, then if we take that away, and if we all live as we kind of do now, I suppose, do you think that without a common goal, is that where this kind of collaboration essentially breaks down and we start to maybe segregate? And, you know, some people would argue that right now there's a lot of segregation in the world and there's a lot of conflict. Do you think that is because we no longer have this shared common goal that we're all working towards?
I think that's a really interesting question, and I think it's partly right. So I think, you know, the one example that really springs to mind that is very salient for everyone still probably is what happened in, you know, when with the pandemic that we to some extent are still in, but, you know, over the last few years, how has that affected our social behaviour? And one thing I think that was really striking in particular at the very beginning of the pandemic was just how much this sense of a shared threat and a shared collective threat motivated people to cooperate. So, I mean, at that point, I still lived in London, and in my neighbourhood, as in many neighbourhoods in the UK and also in other countries, in the very early days of COVID, we saw a sort of real resurgence of grassroots, local, community level cooperation. So lots of things like mutual aid groups were springing up and things like this. And so in one sense, we did see that, you know, we see that when we have these kinds of collective threats, we are able to rise to it, you know, we are able to cooperate. But I think the other sort of insight for me that came from the COVID pandemic was that that kind of cooperation was often quite local in scale. So it wasn't, it was often quite circumscribed. It didn't really, it didn't really sort of scale up to the global or societal level cooperation that was needed a lot of the time. So when you think about things like how vaccines were shared globally, or people's willingness to say, not buy up all the pasta in the supermarket or the toilet rolls and those things. I mean, seems a long time ago now, right? But, you know, we were cooperating in some ways, but we were also, in other ways, we were also behaving, you know, quite selfishly. And so I think there's always this tension between cooperation at different scales, where sometimes we can have a shared threat, whether that is from a virus, something in the environment, or indeed from other groups or other people. And those kinds of threats can galvanize cooperation at one scale. So it can galvanize, if you're against an opposing group, for example, that can galvanize cooperation within your group. But the really difficult thing for our species, I think, and the thing where we struggle, is scaling that cooperation up beyond these sort of local group level boundaries. And that, unfortunately, that is the thing we have to be able to get better at if we want to tackle the global problems that we actually face.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And I think it's a really complex thing to consider, you know, when a lot of people would think about cooperation as compliance. And, you know, again, I reference this idea of future thinking. And I suppose what I'm referring to there is potentially, you know, if you think about the climate crisis and some of the things that are being depicted, I suppose, for the next 20 or 30 or 40 years, and the fact that that essentially is a shared threat. You know, that's something that is going to impact everyone on the planet, some people in places more than others initially. And I suppose that's something that, yeah, I guess, is there I suppose a lesson or something that we need to be considering from our past in terms of how we collaborate and how we cooperate as a species that could essentially, yeah, save us in the future when we're going to have less, maybe less resources. As you described then, it sounds silly to say, oh, okay, people selfishly went up to the supermarkets and tried to hoard their food. But actually, if you think about a time in the future where there may be less food available for a very long time, you know, and resources are going to be a real challenge in certain places in the world, what things do we need to consider there about, yeah, how we can work together to get a better outcome for everyone?
So I think it's a massive question, and it's not, you know, it's obviously, there are no like silver bullet answers to these kind of massive global scale problems. I think one thing that we all could do, and again, just to use, you know, COVID as a really striking example again, is to appreciate that we're actually much more interdependent than we can possibly realize. So, you know, it's very difficult for us to appreciate that the fortunes or, you know, the illness that someone living in a different country, in a different continent might have, could somehow find its way to impacting us. But that is, of course, exactly what has happened and how this pandemic has played out. And in many ways, we have to start getting better at realizing that all of our fortunes on this planet are interdependent, and that what happens to people we don't know, we may never meet, that are living in different places, potentially people that haven't been born yet even, what happens to those people and their fortunes actually concerns us, that we're all kind of in this together in a way. And I think, so I think one appeal I would have is just kind of this trying to like generate this sense of positive interdependence, that like when we all win, when we win together. But I think that the difficulty with that is that it's not intuitive for us. It doesn't really come easily to us to think in that way. And as a corollary of that, I think it isn't that easy for us to move beyond cooperating with at local scales, with people we know, with our friends, with our communities, in our neighbourhoods, to scaling that up to the level at which it's actually needed nowadays. And so one kind of way we might be able to bridge that gap is to do what the late Nobel laureate Eleanor Ostrom called thinking global, acting local. So basically accepting that, you know, we find it pretty difficult to psychologically to kind of cooperate at global scales, but finding ways that we can cooperate locally with people that we know in our neighborhoods at this kind of scale, but in ways that actually don't only generate benefits locally to our neighborhoods, to our friends, to our families, but actually generate global benefits. So that kind of idea of think global, act local, I think has a lot of currency. Like, I think that's something that will be really essential, and it offers a kind of path forwards for us, a hopeful path forwards for us. But it, you know, it's not, isn't going to be easy. And I think one other thing I always kind of think is, I think as a species, we're sort of, in some ways, we can be a bit prone to this kind of like fairy tale thinking about our status on the planet and how, you know, oh, we'll, you know, we'll have this start of a story, and in the middle we'll face some adversity, but in the end it'll all work out okay. And I think the other thing is, I think we really need to snap out of the mindset that everything's all going to be okay, because it will be if we decide to make it okay. But that's a decision we have to take, and you know, we have to realize that actually it's not a fairy tale. There isn't some kind of preordained happy ending for our species that's going to happen whatever we do. And so I think we can resolve some of these global challenges, but I think it really is up to us whether we will do that.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Gosh, yes, so much in there. And I really like this idea of, you know, the local and kind of, I guess, the more individual contribution to, yeah, to the collective, to the group. And it sometimes does sound, doesn't it, a little bit kind of, I don't know, utopic. But the reality is that, yeah, we all have a part to play. And I think it's exciting. I think about tech innovation and, you know, some of the things that I know are potentially going to happen in the world of well-being, health, fitness, data sharing, and obviously what technology allows us to do. And I think that's hopefully going to be really exciting. There's going to be a lot of innovation, I think, around individuals contributing their information, their data, to essentially help. I'm a big fan of Jane McGonigal's work. So she's a futurist, and she talks a lot about scenarioing for future pandemics. And I think really, hopefully, there's a lot of smart people on this planet who are looking at these, I guess, solutions for big problems, but that actually, regardless of whether you think you are the person that's going to change the world or save the world, we all have an individual contribution. And I think hopefully that is hopeful. Hopefully that's exciting. And as an optimist, I always think, you know, we'll get there. But you're right. You know, it's not a guarantee happy ending hero's journey story that I think we like to think about. But you also mentioned around similarities. And so that's something that I'd like to talk about. You know, we probably think about, when I said at the start, the work that you do and looking at human behavior alongside other species. I'm sure there's some like obvious similarities that we can all think about. So our need to eat, our procreate, sleep, there's things that I'm sure we think, well, every species on the planet does that. But are there some other less obvious similarities between us and some other species that might surprise us?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that I do in a way. So that's the kinds of questions that I find super interesting. And so one fact that we know about sociality on this earth is that outside of humans, when we see other species being cooperative, living in groups and things like that, we tend to see that the vast majority of that is happening within the confines of family groups. And there's a good reason for that. Cooperation is favored within families because of the indirect genetic benefits that can that individuals can confer on their relatives by helping them. So we see lots and lots of cooperation within family groups outside of humans. But what we don't see so much of is the kind of thing that we think makes us really quite different, which is cooperating with not only with non-relatives, but also with complete strangers, with people we don't know, people we might never meet again. And there is one species that actually does this that I've worked on quite a bit, which we would never normally think of that we would have much in common with. And the species is called the blue streak cleaner wrasse. And it's a small fish that lives throughout the Indo-Pacific on coral reefs. And I often describe cleaner fish as being a bit like the hairdressers of coral reefs. Mm-hmm. So they have these little cleaning stations where they live, a bit like their hairdressing salons. And they basically stay there. And all the other fish on the reef, who we just, for convenience, we call them the clients, will visit the cleaning station in order to receive a cleaning service, which basically involves the cleaner fish nibbling away any parasites that are on the surface of the client's skin, or even taking away dead skin and things like that. So this seems like it should be, you know, in some ways not a very interesting thing. It's, you know, the cleaner fish gets a meal, the client gets the nasty parasites removed. So in some ways you think, what does this have in common with the kind of cooperation that I'm talking about in humans, where we sort of go out of our way to help strangers and things like that? And that the answer is that, in fact, there's a conflict between the cleaners and their clients, because even though the cleaner fish will eat parasites and dead skin, what it prefers to eat and what it does eat if it's given the chance is the client's living tissues. So it prefers to eat living scales and also mucus, which is a living protective layer that the client has on the surface of its skin. And so now this makes the interaction actually quite interesting from the point of view of understanding cooperation, because we have a situation where we've got these two individuals that have a conflict of interest, but where somehow the interaction has to be resolved cooperatively, even though, you know, there's no police fish swimming around on the reef. They can't talk about it beforehand. You know, the client can't say, right, make sure you only eat parasites and don't bite me. They can't sign a contract or anything like that. So somehow they find a cooperative solution. And strikingly, the mechanisms they use to do it look very similar in a lot of ways to the mechanisms that we use to foster cooperation among strangers in our societies. So we know that in humans, for example, two really important mechanisms for sustaining cooperation where people might otherwise be tempted to behave selfishly or to act in their own self-interest are the threat of being punished for doing that and the possibility to gain status or reputation benefits, or not wanting to look bad, basically. And strikingly, both of those things we also see evidence for in this cleaner fish system. So if a cleaner fish bites a client, they will often be aggressively punished by the client, or even potentially aggressively punished by one of the other cleaner fish that's close by. So they even police one another in those interactions. And secondly, the cleaner fish also seems to have a rudimentary concern for its reputation. So what happens on these cleaning stations is that because there's not as many cleaner fish as the number of clients that need to be cleaned, often the clients are having to wait around a little bit to wait their turn to be inspected by the cleaner fish. And while they're waiting, they can watch what's happening at the cleaning station. And if they see the interaction end badly with the current client, so if they see, for example, the current client swimming away very quickly or maybe even punishing the cleaner fish, often the clients that are waiting will simply swim away and find a different, better cleaning station to visit. And the cleaner fish is aware of that. And if they're being watched in particular by the very valuable clients that have, say, very big clients that are very valuable, have a big food source, they will actually be nicer to the current client they're working on to make sure that the queuing ones won't swim away. And so to me, I found this amazing because I think, well, you'd never think we've got much in common with a fish living on a coral reef. But there we see these kinds of same mechanisms are supporting cooperation among strangers underwater, you know, in the Indo-Pacific as what we see in our own societies.
Yeah, it is absolutely fascinating. And also I like that, the way you paint that picture of, you know, the hairdresser and the idea of people, you know, the fish queuing up almost, and this idea of reputation being so important, and essentially the perception, you know, the perception of others that we give or that they give. And I think that idea of reputation and status is really important, and actually got me thinking about how those things potentially are changing. Because if you think back to, I guess, again, a long time ago, where we would be in proximity to one another, and this idea that, you know, reputation, even if you just look at children, you know, and when, as they're developing in age 2, 3, 4, and how they interact, and when they start to notice this idea of status in a group. And I think that actually, as we're now moving to a world where we are maybe more isolated, maybe we have less proximity, even just thinking about, you know, work situations and people who might be working remotely now on a screen, you know, how do you think is that potentially going to change how the importance of reputation and I guess all that, so much of communication is nonverbal, isn't it? So the observations that these, I guess it's kind of a big leap here, but the observations that those fish are making, they're only seeing it because they're there. So we might pick up on things when we spend time with others in a group, but are those things going to dissipate if we're all working alone and we only check in for an hour on a meeting via a screen? The rest of that time, we're not actually together. So do you think, yeah, the idea of our reputation and status is going to change now that we are essentially much more isolated and remote?
To be honest, not really, because I don't think reputation is only something that we can accrue or lose in sort of face-to-face real world interactions. I mean, like, I'm just thinking about, say, Twitter or any kind of social media platform, where there's a lot of signaling, you know, going on yeah. these platforms. Some people, you know, talk about virtue signaling, other people talk about status competition. So I think there's lots of ways we can use digital technology, and that people do use digital technology to, you know, to try to gain status, whatever that status may be. And also, you know, famously on these platforms, we also take status away from people. So, I mean, like, that's the whole debate around cancel culture and, you know, things like that, is basically, I don't know, taking status and reputation away from people. And
is it as real though? So, for example, the status that we might create for ourselves online, you know, a persona, a personality, a professional brand, you know, even just for an individual, to be able to create something potentially online, you can keep that up, or you can kind of, I don't know, kind of safeguard that through these things, like you say, virtue signaling. Whereas in real life, if you are face to face with a group of people day in, day out, say, for example, in a school environment or an office environment, is it as easy to, I suppose, curate that status and that personality? Or is it like you're going to see people's real, true, you know, some way, if it's the way they respond to things, the way they react, the way they just conduct themselves, their energy, everything like that? Is it more, yeah, face to face every day, is that going to give us a better indication of the truth? Or do you think nowadays, actually, yeah, our online reputations and our online, I guess, personas are, I mean, it's very, I could say it's quite complex, but essentially that's just an extension of who we are.
I think the question is quite interesting. Like, I share your sentiment, and I know what you mean about saying there's a lot of low cost things you can do online that, you know, might burnish your reputation, but are basically maybe not that informative as to your true character. So, you know, just clicking, liking something, I think it's been called slacktivism. You know, there's even been studies that have shown things like the tendency to like a charitable campaign or something like that on Facebook is actually associated with a reduced willingness to support that thing, because once people feel like they've liked it, they don't need to actually, you know, do anything in a way. So I get what you mean. I think that it is the kind of signaling that we see online, because it isn't costly a lot of the time, because it is low cost signaling, is potentially not as informative about somebody's underlying character, or you know in the way that, say, interacting with them on a sustained basis in the real world might be. But what I think the other point that I think is important is that in some ways there's no such thing as a person's true reputation, if you like. So it's not that you can't have a reputation that's an absolute quantity, because reputation is basically in the eye of the beholder. And so while one, you know, you might be able to curate an online reputation, and in the eyes of those beholders online, you might be one thing. And yeah, you might be something completely different to people who interact with you in the real world. And maybe you're something different even among that group as well. So some people think you're great, other people not so much. And I think that that idea that we could even have a kind of absolute quantity of reputation, I don't think we can, in a way. I think that how we're perceived by other people depends on the person who's perceiving. And that's why it's actually so difficult in some respects for us to navigate this this aspect of our social lives, because we often we don't really know. And often what we, you know, something which might improve our status in the eyes of one individual might actually reduce it in the eyes of somebody else. And I think that this is actually a really interesting and quite underexplored aspect of human social behavior, but one that we're actually working on in my lab at the moment, is this: how, you know, how do we actually curate reputations, and how do we understand how our actions will affect what people think of us? And are we accurate? You know, do we do that accurately, or do we tend to not really have a good grasp on how what we're doing will affect our status and our reputation? So I think these are all quite interesting open questions, actually.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I think you're totally right, that idea that, you know, status isn't something that we can take, essentially, or curate. It's actually attributed to us. And yeah, it's given by the others or by the group. And also, you mentioned a while back, actually, this word about strangers. And I think it's kind of when you were talking about the example of the cleaner fish, and, you know, why essentially is it sometimes for us in our, why is it in our benefit to help someone who we don't know? So like you said, outside of the family, outside of the group, we've all probably seen and heard this idea of, you know, random acts of kindness, and we see them and they go viral online when people help someone, or they do something for in service of a complete stranger. So what is going on there, I suppose, from our social behavior lens, when we do something that is completely, you know, not non-beneficial to us at all, it is an act of kindness, it's for a stranger, why do we innately have a desire to do that?
So one thing I'm often accused of, in a way, as an evolutionary biologist, is taking the altruism out of altruism by trying to understand how what you're calling random acts of kindness, or, you know, cooperating, helping strangers, how that can ultimately be beneficial to individuals. And I think it's really important to try and dispel this misunderstanding, because I think a lot of the time what people hear when evolutionary biologists talk about these things is, oh, you think the only reason that I'm doing X, Y, and Z is because I'm going to benefit from it. And that's not the reason. The reason I'm doing it is because I want to do it, and I don't care about the benefits. And I think it's just really important to dispel that's not an argument that we're making. So we're not saying that just because you can reconcile a helpful act with downstream benefits to the helpful individual, we're not saying that the only reason individuals ever help or do anything nice is because they're trying to gain those benefits. And sometimes I use a different analogy, because I think it just really helps to think about how you can separate the motive for doing something and the ultimate evolutionary benefit for doing that thing. So if you imagine, for example, let's say you're on safari and you're lucky enough to see a lioness or some lionesses hunting a gazelle, you might ask yourself, why are they doing that? And on a motivational level, it could be because they're hungry, or maybe they've got cubs to feed or something like that. But on an evolutionary level, we can also say, well, on average, lionesses that do this sort of thing tend to survive better and have more offspring. And so they don't need to be aware of that benefit for them to hunt a gazelle, just like we don't need to be aware of any downstream benefit of helping other individuals for us to be motivated to do it. So I just always try to stress that, because I think there is often a bit of misunderstanding. But once, if we park that for a minute and we accept that the motives that drive behavior can be separate from the evolutionary benefit of doing the behavior, then we can see that actually this tendency to help strangers, to be cooperative, is likely to have been very advantageous to individuals who were cooperative. So we've talked a bit already about reputation and status benefits. Those are really powerful drivers of cooperation. Even when you're helping someone you might never meet again, you can gain, individuals do gain reputation and status benefits from those kinds of unconditionally helpful acts. It can be, like we've also talked about interdependence, it can be that sometimes helping another individual is the best thing for you as well. So when fortunes are intertwined, it can be directly beneficial for you to help other individuals because you benefit as a byproduct of them benefiting. So there are lots of ways we can reconcile a tendency for helpful behavior with an evolutionary advantage without actually calling into question the purity of anybody's motives, or, you know, without even really thinking about motives, actually, even though motives are interesting in their own right. And I think that's something that you want to talk about in a moment. But
Yeah, it is. And thanks for explaining it in that way, because I know it's very complex. And of course, these things aren't as simple as, you know, I understand the motivation behind why I'm doing this. Somebody might say, well, actually, it's like you say, an innate or subconscious, or even I'm just thinking right down to the kind of nurturing element that, again, going back to children, that I see in very young children of, say, for example, I don't know, they've got a doll and the doll's, they'll put a plaster on the knee and they say, oh, I want to make it better, and give them a medicine. And like, it sounds, again, quite a simple example, but it's this idea that nurturing is actually innate for some people, and it's something that we want to do to help others. But then again, on a much different scale, when it is, yeah, for example, some random person in the street, or, you know, someone says, oh, hey, I've lost my wallet, could you lend me £5 to get the £10 to get the train, or whatever, and you're never going to see that person again, then yeah, I think it is interesting to explore, well, actually, why is it that I believe, anyway, again, as an optimist and as someone who does, I guess, give people the benefit of the doubt, and I do believe that, you know, I see the good, I think actually a lot of people, again, even though if you just go on Twitter today, you might see a lot of shouty people, a lot of divisiveness, a lot of anger, it might seem like everybody in the world is yelling at one another, but actually I think we see more and more that people do want to help others. People do want to, you know, again, going back to what you said about the pandemic, people would, you know, really, this local idea of, you know, knocking on your neighbor's door and seeing how they were doing, or, you know, just contributing. And I do think that, again, the optimist in me is hopeful that people are innately, whatever, for whatever reason, they want to do things in service of others, regardless of if, yeah, the initial impact is good for them. But moving on to the idea of motivations, and obviously motivation, I suppose, is a topic that I talk about a lot on this show and in my book and in my work. But when it comes to how self-motivated we are, or how self-determined we are, do you believe that, again, this kind of idea of being self-motivated, people often ask me, Adrienne, does it come down to nature or nurture? Are you just a motivated person? Are some people just self-motivated and others aren't? And I guess linking it back again, are we more motivated to do things that benefit ourselves, or are we more motivated to take action, to do things, to be galvanized when the benefit will benefit an entire group? So I guess I've got two questions there. First one, motivation. Do you think it's nature, nurture?
Oh, sorry. I think for sure, like, there's some aspects of it that are built in. So if you want to say, like, that's nature, I mean, we're hugely empathic. And so, you know, you mentioned a moment ago about empathy and wanting to, you know, the idea of a child wanting to nurture a doll. And like, that is something which is, you know, all humans have a capacity for empathy and experience empathy to varying degrees. But one thing that's quite interesting is that actually the extent of that empathic concern is quite bounded and it is quite fickle. So there's an effect in psychology called the identifiable victim effect, which is that we often feel more empathy when we're confronted with the plight of a single identifiable individual than when we're confronted with the plight of, you know, lots and lots of individuals suffering. And this is a bit strange if you think about it from a psychological point of view, because, you know, in some ways, the more suffering, the more that should actually kind of trigger an empathic response. But somehow, you know, our brains are not really, don't seem to be wired that way. And so I think there are some elements of motivation to help that are sort of come preloaded in a way. And then there are other aspects of that which can be nurtured during development or which can be learned. And so, like, for example, this, you know, the wanting to help larger numbers of people or feeling empathy for larger numbers of people would be something that actually I think would have to be actively sort of learned during development in a way, because it isn't something I don't think that people are necessarily, it's not an intuitive or a sort of innate thing to do, but we obviously, you know, we are able to do it with experience. So like all the interesting questions in psychology, I mean, nature, nurture, it's always a bit of both, basically.
Yeah, a bit of both. And it's making me think of the example that you said about the group of when apparently statistically, you know, when people see an accident or a crisis, if there's no one else around, people are more likely to intervene and to rush over and to help. Whereas if there's lots and lots of people around, people think, oh, actually someone else will do it. So then they don't.
Yeah, so that's the effect in psychology is the bystander effect, which is a very well documented effect of if I'm the only person, and someone needs help, I'll do it. Whereas the more people there are, actually, the more chance there is of there being inaction. And again, I mean, these kinds of insights, I think, are quite relevant for us when we start thinking about, you know, global problems that do require global cooperation, but where we seem to also, you know, have a bit of inaction and collective, you know, paralysis in some ways of actually taking the first step to do something and to try to affect change.
Yeah, and I guess that's, you know, again, we talked about it before with this idea of collaboration versus compliance. But yeah, I guess when we think that the problem is really, really huge, so for example, the climate crisis or, you know, sustainability issues, I do think, again, it's that bystander effect kind of probably comes into play because you think, well, my contribution is so small that actually if everybody else is doing it or if everybody else isn't doing it, then it doesn't really matter. You know, my contribution doesn't really matter, or that, you know, someone else is going to come up with a solution and then we'll either have to do it or we won't. And it's, again, it's interesting. I had this kind of debate with someone recently that said, actually, things have to be mandatory. We have to make people change their behavior. Otherwise, they never will. So yeah, I think it'd be interesting, I suppose, to see which things are going to potentially become mandated in order for us to make those changes.
Yeah, I mean, what sort of things do you have in mind? Like, what sort of things are you thinking would be mandatory?
Well, it might be things to do with food consumption. So, for example, if there's less, you know, land in the future which can be farmed and there's less agriculture, maybe there's less animals on the planet that we can eat, then maybe actually we can't just say to people, eat less meat. You know, maybe it actually has to become mandated of how much meat people can consume. And although some people would think, oh my gosh, Adrienne, that sounds so far-fetched, so crazy. You know, again, you think back to the pandemic, we all had to do things that we probably never thought we would have had to do. So if someone said you are not allowed to get on a flight unless you have this vaccine, people would have said no way, people can't make people do things. But I do, again, thinking about futurism, and I'm fascinated by this, I think there could be a lot of things in the future that we may be forced to do or mandatory, you know, that, for example, again, let's say whether it's a different virus or a different disease or something that causes, you know, bigger segregation essentially, then yeah, I think we could see a lot of changes and a lot of mandatory things that will very quickly, that, you know, stages of change, very quickly we'll accept them and we'll adapt because we'll be forced to.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of sounds authoritarian, but I know what you mean, and I guess what I would say in response is that in many ways that won't be such a different scenario for our species, because we're already we already live by so many different norms, rules, whether they are explicitly sort of described and enforced or more implicitly enforced or socially enforced. And we're like, in part, that's also part of the reason that we have been able to sort of scale up cooperation from beyond the realms of these small family groups and to live in the massive large scale societies that many of us live in nowadays. Like those kinds of arrangements, social arrangements, wouldn't be possible if we didn't have a set of shared rules, norms, guidelines that we sort of adhere to broadly. And so I don't really disagree in some respects, that like maybe additional rules will come into force in the future. That's kind of, in some respects, that's part of what has been happening continually over human evolution, and in particular cultural evolution of these different norms and things like that, is always has always changed and is always changing. And that's really important. Like, that's the ability to create and enforce standards and rules of behavior is critical for our success. So while I don't want to basically come across as being some kind of authoritarian scientist, but like, if you just think about it in a more abstract way, we already are rules driven species, and I don't really see it. I don't think it's that controversial in a way to suggest that we will continue to invent new rules in the future. And I guess the controversy is like, what will those be and how will they be enforced? But
I agree with you. I think we are, of course, without rules and I suppose order and structure, then potentially what would it be? Complete chaos. But I agree with you, it's going to be, the controversy will be around how and when, and also how fast people are expected to adapt to change. Because I think that what we saw with the pandemic was certain things we had to change quickly. Certain things were just like, this is the rule and you got to get on board and that's it. And I think that's where the controversy or the backlash or people's resistance comes, is because people need time to, accept an idea, think about it, change their behavior. They don't like shock. We don't like shock, do we? We don't like quick changes. And so I think you're right. I think things will, of course, inevitably, we're always living within rules and systems. But I think it's when those rules and systems change quickly, that's when we might have a problem.
These are like super interesting empirical questions in a way. Like, to what extent are we willing to change the rules? Like, when I think that, I don't think we have like really good answers yet on a scientific level for like, what, how do people respond to rule changes? And again, not to just be the kind of, it's a bit more complicated than that person, but like, it will also depend on, I think probably one thing it will really be critical on is people's perceptions of how do these rules affect me? Like, what am I gaining from this rule? What am I losing from it? Do I believe the narrative for why this rule is important? So like, in the context of COVID, for example, different people could, it was easier for some people to follow the rules than for other people. So for someone like me, it was basically quite easy to follow a lot of the social isolating rules, because I happen to work in a job where if I don't have to leave, if I can't leave the house, it's not a big problem. I can still get paid and, all that kind of thing. Whereas like, for some people that just wasn't feasible, right? So like, depending on what the rule is and how it's going to impinge on you and your ability to meet your basic needs, you'll get different kind of endorsement or acceptance of those rules. And that's always going to be the case with any kind of rule that we sort of collectively try to come up with and enforce. And I think that's the difficulty in a way, is like navigating the complexity of the issue. Like, how do we get people on board with these things, even though this is going to differentially impact people, and it's going to have different impacts on different people, and that will affect how willing they are to abide by these things. I think those are like super interesting questions that almost like have to tackle on a case by case basis.
Yes, exactly. And also have to be open to a variety of different outcomes and answers. So for example, having like a list of, you just talked about then exceptions to the rule, having a list of exceptions to the rule, and even just as an individual, asking yourself, what would make you break that rule? So again, Jane McGonigal, when she talks about future pandemics and scenarioing, I suppose, they asked people, if there was a pandemic where these things happened, what would make you break that rule? And so when people actually sat down and thought about it with, relations to an influenza pandemic like COVID, it was things like, well, I would break the rule if I wanted to leave the house to go to a religious festival or, a funeral, or things that we actually saw people were willing to break the rules in certain settings. So I think, again, that's also something to consider, is like, when would you personally, and again, it doesn't have to necessarily be about the group right now, but just thinking to yourself, okay, which rules would I, or when there is a new rule, what is it that would make me potentially break that rule? What are those kind of exceptions? Because as you say, fascinating stuff to think about, and I love this kind of thing. I could do this all day, but sadly I don't have all day to sit and talk with you, Nicola. I'm conscious of your time, and I always conclude the the podcast with the section around the Power Hour and the concept of the Power Hour. So it's very simple. It's all about the first hour of every single day. So for me, for years and years and years now, I think it's maybe 7 years, I have, you know, dedicated the first hour of my day to doing something very intentional. And I believe that it sets me up for a brilliant day ahead, whatever I'm doing. So before I ask you the question about your Power Hour, because I'd love to hear what you do in the morning, I guess we were talking a lot about, you know, different species, behavior, and also we haven't really even mentioned that much about the book. So I'd love if you could kind of tell people a little bit more about the book. But is there anything to say that other animals or other species have a way of measuring time? So obviously not in the way that we do, which is hours or days or weeks, but other than just day and night, have you seen in your work there are any other species who know that it's the morning or that measure time?
Well, I've got a dog and he definitely knows when it's dinner time, and you can set your clock by him essentially. And so you know, anecdotally, yes. But there's also like a bunch of super interesting studies on species like squirrels and scrub jays, species that are called caching species. So basically they're species that they find food now and they hide it somewhere so they can eat it later, basically. So they hide food in different places. And there's been a bunch of really interesting work done by Professor Nikki Clayton at Cambridge showing that a lot of these species that cache food, that hide it away so they can eat it later, have a representation of what they have hidden and whether it's perishable or not. And depending on the interval that you give them to go and retrieve the food, they will either, if it's a short interval, they'll preferentially go and retrieve the stuff that will go off quickest. But if it's a longer interval, they just won't go back for the stuff that will have gone off. So I think like this kind of concept of time and why that matters, you can find that in lots of species, you know, from my dog downstairs who will wait there at 5 p.m. every single day looking at me, to something like a squirrel or a scrub jay that knows, okay, the worms are probably not great now, I'll go for the nut or something like that.
Wow. Yeah, it is fascinating, because as someone who thinks about time a lot and talks about time and how valuable time is, and I sometimes, yeah, I've had this conversation with people before where it was actually more about like consciousness and thinking about the future and future planning, and thinking, well, actually, does the dog sit and think, oh, what am I going to do next Thursday or in 6 months or in,
not.
You know,
not that's in that the really thing. Interesting thing. There's basically no evidence. That's the thing that I think is quite different between humans and other species, is this idea of foresight and future planning. There's some evidence in chimpanzees that maybe they do this. So for example, they sometimes, if they find a really good tool, they'll keep hold of it and they'll take it with them to the place where they can crack the nuts, for example. So it seems like maybe they are planning something for, like, you know, they're thinking about the future. But for the vast majority of species, that capacity to imagine a future and to think about what might happen in that future is, as far as we know, we don't really see that in other species. So that is, you know, that's something quite special about humans in a way.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful thing that we can do. As someone who's a big future thinker, it's a wonderful thing to be able to think about the future. But it also, of course, as we know, comes with a cost, because often for a lot of people, thinking about the future is actually what causes them worry, stress and anxiety. Whereas our pets are just, you know, enjoying their afternoon nap and they're not stressed about next week.
Totally, yeah.
So can you tell us, Nicola, what do you do in the first hour of your day, and what time does your day typically start?
I feel like my day's start is not going to be as impressive as yours. So our house is a bit of a madhouse. I've got 2 young kids and a dog. So the start of the day is invariably chaotic. It will almost always involve, I do tend to exercise every day. So that's one thing I try to, I'll either run with the dog. If it's the weekend, I go out on my bike. I'm a very avid cyclist. So yeah, some kind of exercise, a cup of tea, general chaos, basically, trying to get 2 kids out of the house and to school.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound that different to mine, to be honest. So, yeah, I think a lot of people in the mornings, that's, to be honest, that's why my power hour started in the first place, because I thought, actually, I need to carve out a bit of space and time before all of those things happen. But thank you so much, Nicola. I found this conversation fascinating. I knew that I would. I know that we kind of went like here, there and everywhere and, you know, trying to connect the dots between all of these different things and these big, big questions. But I really, really appreciate your time. So thank you very much for joining us.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me on.
And before you go, please can you tell everyone where they can get the book, The Social Instinct?
Oh, yeah. Available in anywhere you might buy books, all good bookstores, online. Should be able to find it anywhere. And it's just come out in paperback with a new subtitle, in case, because that has confused some people. It's now called The Social Instinct, What Nature Can Teach Us About Working Together.
Wow, brilliant. Thank you so much. And thanks everyone for tuning in and listening. I'll be back next week with another episode. See you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.